It's nice to be here. I've been away for about 6 months, so it's nice to be back and seeing all of you here. So for the next 4 weeks, I'm going to be doing a four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. And to explore this, I'd like to take the Buddha's advice on how to develop wisdom. He suggests that wisdom is cultivated in three ways: through listening, and in his day that was how the tradition was transmitted, was orally, so that would include reading now. So through listening and reading, through reflection, through thoughts, and through the practice of cultivating the mind, or meditation.
So I'd like to incorporate all of those aspects of cultivating wisdom into this class. So I'll share some of the teachings of the Buddha, actually reading some of his words from the suttas, and we'll have discussion about this topic. And we'll do some reflective practice. I'll teach you a reflective meditation style of practice that we can use to understand these topics through a different mode of meditation than the normal mindfulness practice. And then aside from the meditation that we'll use to begin the evening with, I'll also be talking about how we can bring mindfulness to these truths, these Four Noble Truths, in our daily lives. So we'll hopefully bring all of these aspects into the class. So in the first discourse the Buddha gave after his enlightenment, he laid out the fundamentals of what he learned in the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So in this first discourse, as he put these truths out, he didn't just put them out as dogma, as statements to be believed. He put them out as truths to be acted on. So associated with each of the four truths, there is an action or a practice that goes along with each of the truths. So the truth of suffering, the first noble truth, is meant to be understood. The truth of the cessation of suffering, or the origin of suffering, I'm sorry, the truth of the origin of suffering is meant to be abandoned. The truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated. So I think that this teaching, the fact that there's an action associated with each of these truths, shows us the practical aspect of the Buddha's teachings. At its core, the Buddhist teachings are not simply truths to be believed and to have faith in. They are really meant to be put into practice. We are meant to act ourselves, to look at the suffering in our lives, to understand it, so that we can abandon the causes of suffering and then realize in our own lives the release, the happiness of the cessation of suffering, and to cultivate, take the actions to cultivate the qualities of heart and mind that lead to the cessation of suffering. In another discourse, the Buddha suggested that his followers use this framework of the Four Noble Truths as a kind of a frame of reference. Tanjeff likes to call the Four Noble Truths a frame of reference for understanding our experience. Rather than the usual frame of reference we use, the usual frame of reference we use for understanding our experience is self. We operate in this world as a self, and that's how everything comes in. Everything comes in reference to me. And the Buddha suggests instead that we use this framework of the Four Noble Truths to understand our experience. And I'll read a little bit of this sutta so that you get a little bit of the flavor of his words on this subject. This is going to be excerpts. So
So he says, an untaught ordinary person, that's us, does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things unfit for attention and does not attend to those things fit for attention. This is how he attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present, thus, am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? A well-taught, noble disciple understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. Attending wisely, he attends, this is suffering. He attends wisely, this is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, fetters are abandoned in him, which basically means that there is a liberating process that takes place. So basically what he's saying is that when we're caught up in all of our normal referencing of the world in terms of self, we will suffer. And that as we change our perspective and look at our experience in terms of these Four Noble Truths, they become a kind of, they're like facets through which we can view our experience. And as we start to do that, we can start to unpack the ways that we suffer, and they begin to dissolve and to disintegrate. The Buddha is often quoted as saying, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And when I first heard this, I thought, that's two things. And in fact, I have looked this up, this translation or this section up. And some translations do say, I teach two things. Some translations say, what I taught formerly and now is only suffering and the end of suffering. So clearly there is latitude for different interpretations. And I'm not a Pali scholar, so I don't know what he actually said in this regard. But I will say that it led me to some reflection about what does it mean that he said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And what I discovered or understood, began to understand for myself, is that when we really see suffering, when we really understand suffering without resistance, without aversion, when we really deeply understand suffering, it ends. It is the same thing. Understanding suffering is the end of suffering. So to me, it was an interesting exploration. And one ongoing exploration in my practice is how seeing any one of these Four Noble Truths in our experience does allow us to see the others. So I think that's something for each of you to look at in your own practice, but I think it is part of the nature of these truths that really deeply seeing into any of them reveals all of them. So during the course of these 4 weeks, we'll go into each of these four truths and the action associated with each one. So tonight, I'll start with the truth of suffering, or the Pali word for that is dukkha, and understanding suffering. So the Pali for the First Noble Truth is dukkha satcha. And satcha in Pali means truth, and dukkha is usually translated as suffering. So life is suffering is how some people interpret the First Noble Truth. And often people have some kind of reactivity against that particular translation of the First Noble Truth because there's so many aspects of our life that don't seem to be suffering. But the meaning of dukkha in the context of the Four Noble Truths is much broader and subtler than the meaning that we normally give to suffering. And some scholars have translated dukkha as unease, dissatisfaction, stress. So there are different ways to translate this term, and I think some of these alternative translations help convey more of the breadth and subtlety of the term. Often I will just use the term dukkha because it really can't be adequately translated into English. Perhaps fewer people would object to the translation dissatisfaction is a truth of life. So even when our lives are going well, we almost are always dissatisfied with something. We want this or that small or large change in our lives. We want a different body. We want to be thinner. We want to have our weight distributed in different ways. We want to have a better car, a different job. We just want all kinds of things. We want to have more money. We want to be relaxing when we're busy. We want to be busy when we're bored. So the Buddha said there are three kinds of suffering, three different kinds of dukkha. The dukkha due to pain, the dukkha due to change, and dukkha due to existence. And I'll talk about each of these. The first type of suffering, the suffering due to change, is given the term in Pali, dukkha dukkha. I like that. This is a type of dukkha or suffering that we're all familiar with. It's so obvious that we don't miss the fact that we're suffering. But I want to pause here for a moment and point out that when the Buddha speaks about dukkha, when the Buddha speaks about suffering, it's not the mental or physical pain that he's referring to. When we're suffering in this way, the suffering due to mental or physical pain, usually we think of the suffering being the pain itself. But what the Buddha says is that it's not the pain itself that is the dukkha. It's not the pain itself that is the suffering. It's the reaction to the pain, either mental or physical, that is the suffering. So it's the idea in the mind that this shouldn't be happening. Something else should be here. That is the dukkha. So the pain itself, either mental or physical pain, is an unpleasant experience in the mind or body, sometimes extremely unpleasant experience. The reaction, what happens to that unpleasant experience is we react to it. We may contract physically in our body, tighten in our body, or we react in our minds. And this reaction can actually set up a kind of a feedback loop, a positive feedback loop that spins on itself, serving to increase the physical pain. So that's one way in which the reaction causes us the suffering. But perhaps even more often, we react to small physical pain or small emotional pain with strong emotional reactions, which compounds the suffering because the emotions are so unpleasant. So a simple, silly example of this might be, suppose you've got a cold, and you've got a little runny nose, and your body feels unpleasant, and you've got a headache, and maybe a fever. And what the mind might do with that is something like this. I can't have this cold right now. I've got a presentation I have to do tomorrow at work. I cannot be sick right now. And that dinner party I have this Friday, I can't cancel that. This is just not going to work. And what if it's the flu? Well, then I'm going to be sick for 2 weeks. I should have gotten that flu shot. How stupid could I have been for not getting that flu shot? The mind will just go on and on about in a kind of a cycle of reactivity over the fact that you've got these physical symptoms. And it makes the situation worse, because you're reacting about the presentation and the dinner party and the fact that you didn't get the flu shot.
If we simply attended to the physical sensations, we'd perhaps find an unpleasant pressure in the head, a feeling of heat in the body, a kind of an exhaustion in the body, not wanting to get out of bed. When I've been able to actually simply attend to physical sensations when I've been ill in that way, a simple illness I'm talking about, of course, like a cold, I find a mixture of pleasant and unpleasant sensations. The body can actually feel quite pleasantly relaxed if we're not fighting to get out of bed to do things that we'd normally be doing when we're well. So we really compound our suffering through that kind of reactivity. In certain states of meditation that I've experienced, particularly on retreat, but I think it can also happen in our daily meditation, you can actually experience a fairly strong pain in the body, a knee pain or a pain in the hip, simply as an unpleasant sensation. And it's quite surprising when that starts to happen, that when there's no reactivity to a painful sensation like that, it is not experienced as pain. It's quite amazing that the vast majority of what we call pain is in the mind. There is physical unpleasant sensation, but in certain states of meditation, we can really see how the reactivity of the mind makes it feel like pain, and that there is not pain, as we normally call it, when the mind is not reacting. So the second type of dukkha is the dukkha due to change. And this in Pali is got a kind of an obscure term. Viparinama dukkha is the name of this. This refers to the type of suffering we experience when something pleasant ends. So even when things are going well in our lives, it may only take an instant for something to change that. It might be an accident, the death of a loved one, a diagnosis of cancer, something happens like that, and in an instant our orderly lives, or what seemed to be orderly lives, are disrupted. We can't control the circumstances in our lives and keep ourselves completely secure, but we seem to have the illusion that we can. We can control our lives. And when that illusion gets disrupted, when it's pointed out to us that we actually know we don't have control through something that happens like this, it's very unpleasant. It's very disturbing to us. We may blame ourselves and feel like we've done something wrong. We may blame somebody else and get angry. But this dukkha due to change, this viparinama dukkha, is not limited to this kind of dramatic change in our lives. It may be very simple. It has many gradations. It can go from this type of dramatic change to perhaps the feeling of pain when a partner ends a relationship, which can be fairly strong pain. We might experience loneliness or fear if they go away on a business trip. Or we might feel sadness if we lose a favorite raincoat or break a favorite mug. If a period of joy and happiness in our lives ends, we may feel like we've done something wrong. So the suffering due to change results from a reaction to the change rather than being inherent in the change itself. We think when things are going well that this is the way things are supposed to be. It's just the natural course of things, that things are supposed to be this way. And when they change, as everything does, everything changes, we take it personally and we think, what did I do wrong? Why did this happen to me? A kind of a silly example of this, pointing this out to me, came on one retreat, a 3-month retreat that I did. And during this retreat, I was a vegetable chopper. And at one point during the retreat, we were peeling beets. And I was experiencing despair while I was peeling these beets. And in an interview not too many days before that, Joseph Goldstein, my interview teacher, had told me, everything is a possible source of insight. Every mind state you're experiencing is a possible source of insight. So just pay attention to whatever happens. So remembering that instruction, I just said, okay, well, despair is what's happening. What is the landscape of despair? So I was just observing my physical sensation, observing any experiences that were coming up in the body as I was peeling these beets. And I noticed as I was peeling them this beautiful pattern that was being revealed as I peeled the beets. I don't know if any of you have ever peeled beets, but sometimes they produce this beautiful pattern, a white and red pattern along the beets. And I remembered that several weeks before, when we had been peeling beets, that as I saw this pattern revealed, I was experiencing a tremendous amount of joy. It was such a wonderful thing to see this pattern unfold under my peeler that I was joyful about the experience. And the despair that I was experiencing that day was connected to the joy that I had been experiencing. I saw that I felt like there was something wrong with me or with my practice, that I wasn't experiencing the joy that I had been experiencing. And when I saw that I was in despair over beets, I actually started laughing. And it changed my experience again. So it really pointed out to me how change is the change of the experience. When we lose something we had, we think we should be experiencing, we suffer. We could say that suffering is hidden within pleasant experience. The third type of dukkha is the dukkha, the suffering due to existence. This type of dukkha could be called the Buddhist version of existential anxiety. It includes the subtlest forms of unease that we experience in our lives. The Buddhist texts say this form of dukkha is related to the burdensome nature of existence. And without getting too esoteric about it, basically, it's just the fact that we have to take care of this body. I mean, we have to get up in the morning, we have to brush our teeth, we have to put our clothes on, we have to feed ourselves, we have to take ourselves to work and earn the money so that we can pay our mortgages, we have to eat a lunch, we have to work some more, we have to maybe pick the kids up at school and get them home and feed them and get them to bed and do some paperwork over our finances at dinner and then fall into bed exhausted at night and get up the next day and do it all over again. It's just that feeling of, isn't there more than this? You know, that just, this is just life has to happen to feed ourselves, to clothe ourselves. There's stuff that has to happen. And that's the burdensome nature of existence, that part of what they're referring to in this Sankhara dukkha is the Pali for this dukkha due to existence. Another way to look at this Sankhara dukkha is to look at and pay attention to experience that's relatively neutral in our lives. So what happens to you when there's not much happening? I find often, you know, the mind will get bored, it'll feel vaguely dissatisfied, it'll perhaps construct a fear or a fantasy. And we're actually addicted to the highs and lows of life. We crystallize ourselves around these experiences, around these highs and lows. We prefer the highs, but if we're honest with ourselves, we crystallize ourselves around the lows too. And when we experience something relatively neutral, we get really uncomfortable. It's like there's no feedback to say, who am I? What's happening here? What am I supposed to be doing? So we don't get that kick of crystallization around the neutral experience. So I'll have more to say about the truth of dukkha, and particularly about understanding dukkha. But right now what I'd like to do is to guide you in a reflective meditation for a couple of minutes so that you can explore this topic of dukkha in your own minds in a reflective way. So this process of reflective meditation, I learned this from Ajahn Amaro, a monk who is the abbot up at the Abhayagiri Monastery in Ukiah that many of you I know have met. So basically the process of this reflective meditation is to sit in stillness for a few minutes and then to drop a word into the stillness and just see what bubbles up. What kind of physical reactions are there in the body to this word? What kind of thoughts appear? What kind of emotional reaction there might be to this word? And then to just let go of any thoughts, so not to proliferate on thoughts and images and moods that appear, but just say, I felt a sadness, or I felt a tightness in my body, or I had this thought about a friend who's sick, or whatever happens. And then just come back to the stillness and that word again. So you just keep coming back to the silence and the stillness and see what comes up from the non-thinking part of your mind and body. So we'll sit for a few minutes, and then I'll drop the words into your meditation, and just see what happens to you. So we'll sit for probably just a couple minutes, and then I'll start saying a few words. Dissatisfaction,
stress. Suffering. Ease. Some of you may have noticed some physical reactions, some emotional reactions, thoughts that came up. Is anybody willing to share anything about what they experienced?
I think the first word was it?
Dissatisfaction. That's great, to just feel it in the body. Yeah, just to see what comes up bodily. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, I just noticed that the negative words caused my whole body to tense. Mm-hmm. And my knees was okay.
I threw that in at the last minute thinking, I don't want to just leave them with suffering. So... Yeah, it's actually a really potent lesson to realize how we react. I mean, just words. It's just words that are being in there, and that the body responds to simply words, both the easeful ones and the stressful ones. So it's a very interesting lesson to point out to ourselves how the mind is responsible for a lot of what we experience.
I felt some body sensations, but I also
That's an interesting thing to notice.
Sort of yeah. Thinking without real thought, but I can just feel like my brain tells me.
Oh. That's okay. Yeah.
I was with the way the employees were treating the members, and it was making me feel, I'm only a volunteer, and I felt like I was so frustrated because I can't take the authority to tell them, you know, you're not treating them with respect. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be participating in these exercises. And then I was like, all those like first three ones just really tied together, and I was reflecting on like it's like I was being held back by actually being able to change, and like I can see them suffering, and kind of reflected on myself and like feeling like you have no purpose, like you can't do anything about it, and I didn't really feel any ease at the end of it. I was still kind of frustrated because I go and it's like you can't do anything.
Well, we can't do anything necessarily about the external situation, but we can. We have some control over, well, not complete control, but something to say about our reaction to it. And that's really where I think this class, I hope, will help to give you some insight into how to work with things that are difficult. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So I'd like to continue because I have some more things to say. So I'd like to talk a little bit about understanding dukkha. The Buddha enjoined us to understand suffering, to know suffering. So what does that mean? In the Buddha's first discourse, he broke down each of the four truths into, not only it had an action associated with each of the truths, but each of the truths has three insights that are associated with it. So for the first noble truth, the three insights are, this is suffering. The second is, suffering should be understood. And the third is, suffering has been understood. So I'm going to go over each of those three. So this first, this is suffering. What that points out to us is that we need to recognize suffering as suffering. We need to actually know when we are suffering. We can be so caught in the content of what's happening, in he's done this to me or she's done that, and just in the story, that we don't actually recognize that we're suffering. The recognition that we're suffering is often unpleasant. I think that's why we stay caught in the story, because we don't want to feel the unpleasantness of knowing that we're suffering sometimes. So that recognition that we're suffering is an unpleasant experience, but it is an insight. At one point in my practice, very early in my practice, I was experiencing a lot of anger. The anger is actually what got me into the practice in the first place. And I noticed that I believed that this anger would somehow hurt the person I was angry with. And while I was caught in this belief, I didn't feel the suffering myself. I was so caught up in the idea that this is going to hurt him. It's going to hurt him. And it actually became obvious pretty quickly that this wasn't going to hurt him, because in this experience, I was in the Peace Corps. I was in the South Pacific, 7,000 miles away, and he was in the Bay Area. So it was pretty clear that my being angry was not going to do much to him. But I could really feel what it was doing to me, how it was eating me up, how it was burning me up. It made me non-functional at times, this anger. So that recognition that I was suffering was really the kind of impetus to actually begin to change, to do something about it. So that recognition was an insight for me. I'm suffering. I'm angry. I'm the one that's getting burned about this. So mindfulness helps us to disentangle from the content of our experience. So in my case, the anger at my friend who was 7,000 miles away, the story of that, he did this, he shouldn't have done that, it keeps us away from the actual experience of the anger and the suffering in our own bodies and minds. And the mindfulness helps us to disentangle from that content to actually experience what's happening, and helps us to see how we contribute to our own suffering. So when we do see that we are suffering, experience this unease, distress, this anger, whatever emotional state is the suffering. The second aspect, the second insight that the Buddha talked about, is that we should recognize that it's valuable to understand it, that it's valuable to recognize it as suffering, it's valuable to experience it. So this understanding that the Buddha is talking about, understanding the suffering, is not a thinking process that's happening. It doesn't mean you think about why they did this and why they did that and how could I have prevented this, that, or the other thing. It's not that kind of understanding. It's understanding what the experience of suffering is right now in this very moment. How does it make your body feel? How does it make your mind feel right now in this very moment? That's what understanding suffering means. That's what the Buddha meant when he said understand suffering. So the second insight, suffering should be understood, is the recognition that it's valuable. It's valuable to spend time just experiencing that feeling in your mind and body. There's a wonderful poem by a poet named Rumi that celebrates this recognition that suffering should be understood. So I'd like to read that. Some of you have probably heard this. It's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So a good way of being with the distressing situation is to see how it makes our body feel. That really helps to get us out of the thoughts in the mind, to just come into the body and see, where does it make me feel tight? Does it make me feel hot? Does it make me feel pressure and tense? Does it contract the shoulders? Does it make the hands tight, the eyes tight? What does it do to the body to feel this suffering that I'm experiencing? And moods also, we can feel moods in the body. Most moods will have some impact on the body. So where do we feel despair? Where do we feel depression? How do we feel anger, frustration, resentment? How does that get manifested in the body? That can help to take us out of getting caught and identified with that emotion itself. I'm a depressed person. I'm an angry person. To just say, this is what depression feels like right now. And a moment later, it's probably going to feel slightly different. So it helps. It can begin to help break apart the solidity of the experience, to notice that the experience in the body changes over time. And besides attending to the physical sensations, it can help to notice what thoughts appear, what moods appear, images associated with the distressing situation. But do take care with that, because we tend to, when we notice those, sometimes it's real easy to just go right off into thinking about the story again, that he said, she said, he did, I did, they did. That whole story can come up again. So it's really helpful to keep coming back to the body, even if you notice and take note of certain thoughts that happen. at first, paying attention to suffering like this in our body, noticing these moods, these thoughts that come through, it can take a little bit of faith to do this, because it is so unpleasant to be in this space of suffering. But as we do this, as we start to pay attention in this way, we really begin to see that actually the body and mind likes to be paid attention to in this way. It likes to, it's like holding a child that's angry or upset, you know, to just have that contact and let them be the way they are. That attention to, of mindfulness to a situation of suffering has that quality of just witnessing the experience. And we begin to see that it's the type of suffering, the experience that we have in that experience of being mindful of suffering, it's the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. We begin to see that. And we can actually also begin to see that sometimes we can see the ending of suffering. We can see that in a moment, a particular experience of anger or frustration disappears for a few minutes. Maybe it'll come back a few minutes later, but it's gone for even a few minutes. And there's that recognition, oh, wow, I'm free of that, even for just a few minutes. So this is the third insight the Buddha was talking about. Suffering has been understood. We've seen it as suffering, we've recognized it and understood it, and in that recognition of understanding, it can disappear. I had an experience of this. Again, I was in the Peace Corps after this. I had a breakup, this breakup of a 10-year relationship. This person I was so angry with was the person who broke up with me. And often I noticed sadness at night when I was going to bed. And I was in this mode of really just paying attention to what I was experiencing. And so as the sadness came every night, I just started paying attention. Now, it made sense to me. It made perfect sense to me that I was sad when I went to bed. I mean, rationally, psychologically, okay, you know, he's broken up with me. I'm single now. You know, I don't have anybody to go to bed with at night. You know, just that kind of, it made perfect sense to me that I was lonely when I went to bed at night. But so I thought I understood why I was lonely. But I just was paying attention. So each night as I went to bed, I just observed the loneliness. I noticed it coming up. And one night, after four or five nights of paying attention to the loneliness, I noticed that it appeared, that it began. I noticed when it started. It started when I was setting my alarm clock. I had a little digital alarm clock. And as I was setting the alarm clock at night before I went to bed, I noticed the loneliness begin. And I thought, that's odd. What does that have to do with anything? And so I just kept observing each night. And one night, several nights later, I noticed as I was setting the alarm clock, an image flashed through my mind. A brief image flashed through my mind. And the image was being with my boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend, in Disneyland, looking up at a clock, a digital clock, in Tomorrowland. That image had flashed through my mind. And I could see that the loneliness was a reaction to the memory. You know, that, oh, I was so happy then when we were in Disneyland and that will never happen again, you know, that kind of thought. That was where the loneliness came from, was that brief flash of an image that I hadn't seen. And the loneliness came then and there, but I thought, wow, that's fascinating, you know. a brief image like that. So I had a little more clarity of where that loneliness came from. But what really blew me away was the next night when I went to bed, I set my alarm clock. I remembered the whole story. I remembered the image from the night before, and the loneliness didn't appear. It was as if the recognition of the reactivity to that, that it had decoupled it somehow, so that it no longer had the power to, as a fleeting thought unseen, trigger an emotion automatically. So I was blown away by that. I was quite astounded that seeing all of this, you know, in my mind that I remembered the memory and everything, that the loneliness didn't come up. And in fact, that regular routine pattern of being lonely every night when I went to bed, it stopped. So it really showed me that the understanding was not at the intellectual level of, oh yes, I'm single now, I'm alone, going to bed at night by myself. That was not the cause of that loneliness. It was this image that was unseen, triggering a reaction. Of course, I got lonely other times. I mean, I'm not saying that it ended my loneliness, but that regular routine loneliness night to night, that did end. But we can't expect all of our suffering to disappear this easily. Sometimes we have to work over weeks, months, with particular situations, and we have to be compassionate about our limits. So sometimes we can't stay with something very long. Sometimes things are so powerful. That anger that I was experiencing over this man who had broken up with me, it was so powerful. Often all I could do was simply recognize, I'm angry. I'm angry right now. And seeing that if I tried to stay with the anger, if I tried to, you know, just be right there with mindfulness with the anger, the mindfulness wasn't really strong enough for that. I would get swept away by the thoughts, by the story, by the despair, by the frustration. My mindfulness wasn't quite strong enough. So what I did over time was to just notice when it came up, oh, there's the anger. Okay, well, I know that if I try to pay attention to this with mindfulness, I'm going to get caught. Because I'd seen that happen, that I would get caught. So I just let it go. Just let it go and say, I'm going to pay attention to my feet on the ground right now. You know, just take my attention to something neutral. And over time, it really, it increased my ability to pay attention to it. And also, it just simply, just the simple recognition, this is anger, this is suffering. I'm going to let go of it right now in this moment. Over time, it just disappeared. I mean, it took years, but over time, it slowly, the bouts of the anger got farther and farther apart, and one day I just recognized, wow, it's been a long time since I felt that. What happened? And it was gone. I mean, it has not come back since. So really, even just that simple recognition, this is suffering over and over again, without even going into detailed mindfulness of it, just that simple recognition is really, really powerful. So I'd like to suggest a couple of exercises for the coming week for you to play with this. And first I'd like to suggest that you choose one type of suffering or distress to observe in your life. Something like I did with the loneliness. You know, just pick something that kind of occurs on a regular basis. There may be something up for you right now, some kind of emotion or mood or frustration with a particular friend. You could use that. If you've got the motivation to deal with something challenging, go for it. But it doesn't have to be some big thing. It could simply be irritation when your alarm clock goes off in the morning, or you know, some like routine thing, impatience while brushing your teeth. You know, anything that you notice on a regular basis, and just set your intention that you will wake up and pay attention when that experience happens. And just notice the most obvious things that you can. What's happening in the body? What kind of thoughts are happening? What moods are triggered? Just pay attention. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Just notice it for a few moments and then let it go. And you don't have to hold on to suffering to observe it. That's something I've learned over time. And if it is a more painful situation, if it is something really challenging in your life, it can be very skillful, as I just said about the anger that I was describing, to let it go after a few moments, to just notice it, recognize it. Yep, there's that real frustration I'm feeling. Feel it for just a few moments, and then consciously direct your attention away from it to something neutral. Your feeling of your hands. Hands are usually a good thing. Feeling of your butt if you're sitting on a chair. Feeling of your feet on the ground if you're walking. Something just really neutral. Because it can be really skillful to not go too far into those really challenging situations, because they can sweep us away. So we've got a couple minutes if there are any comments or questions or any other thoughts. Yeah.
Thank you. I've been coming for a while, and I think this is the clearest explanation I've ever had on this subject. And maybe I'm just ready to get it finally. But it reminds me of something else that's similar but different, in that when I was feeling very bad, I would work with somebody, and this person would just kind of keep me focused on my pain and just kind of push me into it. And at the end of that, it would kind of dissipate. And that sounds very similar, actually.
Yeah, if you can be present for it without reacting, yeah, it will dissipate. And if somebody is there with you to support you in that, it can help you to be there like that. So it is there can be a similarity. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I know one of the traps I fall into is if I do recognize the suffering, I think I get caught in the thought, oh, not again. When am I ever going to stop being triggered by that? Or why do I keep getting myself into situations that cause this suffering? So I wonder if you could say anything about how to get beyond that.
Yeah, well, that's very common to notice particularly as you start to pay attention and notice, you really start to see these patterns. You get like, wow, look at this. Here I am again being triggered by this same thing. It's you do kind of go through that step essentially. It's sort of like, wow, you know, I thought I'd seen this before, but here it is again. Partly it's just recognizing that is a thought. You know, it's simply a thought in the mind. And notice also the frustration that's associated with that. You know, there's a frustration there that's being added on top of the situation. Just notice that. But you can also, it can be partly too over time. It's just we begin to almost laugh at ourselves for the same patterns over and over again, and we begin to just see, oh, this is just my pattern. This is just the thing that happens to me. And so we begin to take it a little less seriously. And when that starts to happen, it begins to be a little easier to just let go of those thoughts, let go of that sense of, there it is again, and when am I going to ever get over it? It just stops with, oh, there it is again. There it is again, and again, and again. Yeah, these things are going to be with us for a long time. And, you know, like this anger, you know, it was years. It was years of that. So if we can really just have some compassion for ourselves and some understanding that it does take time, that can help to let go of that a little bit. But also recognizing that thought itself. Oh, this is a thought. This is another pattern that comes up. This is another pattern that I have, this idea that I should be getting over this or I shouldn't be triggered by this. That's just another pattern in the mind. So
So recognize that as well. It's after 9, so I think we should end. And may you understand your suffering so that you are free from it. I hope to see you next week. Thank you.